All right, Mr. Chevelle, well, first of all, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy reunion schedule to sit with us to do an interview. And I wonder, could we start by having you describe your life, kind of generally early life in the canal? Were you a second generation person, or did you move there, or did you?
No, I moved there later. I went down to the Panama Canal when I was about 30 to do an internship at Gorgas Hospital. I was interested in tropical medicine and public health, and it was really one of the very, very few places that you could have an approved internship that had any tropical medicine at all. And that's what took me down to the canal zone in the first place. That was in 1961.
Okay.
I did my internship, and then they were short staffed in a couple of areas, and I took the opportunity just to work for about 6 months to make doctor's salary to pay some debts and to save some money. And then after that, went back to the United States. Actually, went to Stanford. And I was there from 1963 to 1970, doing postgraduate medicine, and also for a while in on the staff in community medicine.
Okay.
And then we had children there, two children, and then we went back, thinking we'd go back to the canal zone for a couple of years in 1970. And that stretched on until the time of mandatory retirement for me at age 62 in 1993.
Hmm. And so your children went to high school in Panama?
Yes, they were in kindergarten and first grade when we left California, and they went through their schooling through graduation from high school here.
Oh, wow, okay. Did they, and which high school did they attend there?
Balboa High School.
Balboa High School, okay. And the bust of the school now is down in the museum, right?
Yeah, that was kind of a joke thing. Every year the students would either capture it or they'd paint it pink with green spots. And it was kind of a fun game between the staff and the students who was going to if the students would get away with messing up Balboa statue.
Uh-huh.
That went on all the time.
Uh-huh. What was your impression about kind of social life, political life, comparing it between the Panama Canal Zone and, say, the United States in the 60s and 70s as you went back and forth?
Well, we were in the Canal Zone. We were living in a quite benign system of socialism. Uh-huh. And everybody was salaried who lived there. There were Americans who were in business in Panama City. But the Canal Zone was kind of a socialistic system. Salaries were squashed together, so craftsmen made more relative to the United States, and people at upper levels made less relative to the United States. There were no fancy big houses, and there were no slums, and so the quality of houses also was, I'll call it, squashed together toward a median.
Okay.
Rather than the extremes in either direction.
Mm-hmm.
And we all shopped in a commissary. There weren't really other options. Later, as Panama improved, there were options downtown, but even as late as the 1960s, early 1970s, shopping downtown was not as good as shopping in the Panama Canal commissaries.
Mm-hmm. And did you, as your kids were going through school, what kind of educational experiences did they have in the Canal Zone?
Well, my opinion is that the Canal Zone schools were better, somewhat, even maybe considerably better than most schools in the United States. Now, I'm not going to compare us to urban magnet schools or something like that, but in mm-hmm. general, I think they were quite good. The schools at that time were the Canal Zone schools. After the treaty, they became Department of Defense dependent schools.
Uh-huh.
But in either case, I'd stand by what I said. Part of it is a matter of money. The teachers were paid better salaries in general than in the United States. Mm-hmm. Secondly, there are always folks that are looking for some adventure in life who came to Panama and later to Dodge schools because it just was a thrill to go somewhere, to go work in the jungle, to be where the beaches are. And so I think our schooling was really good. A lot of kids, I think that's another area where you could say this kind of socialistic system made a difference in that a lot of kids, blue-collar workers, ended up going to very good schools in the States and getting their degrees. Mm-hmm. Our kids didn't have any trouble. Our daughter went to Swarthmore and then Harvard Medical School, and our son Alan did a PhD in electrical engineering at Rice. Never felt, I don't think, I can't say I can really speak for them, but mm-hmm. for the most part, I don't think felt handicapped by what they'd had for high school.
Mm-hmm. What was social life like in the Canal Zone?
There were a fair amount of clubs that people belonged to. That was fostered during construction, because early in construction, people were going back to the States almost as fast as they came down here, because there were no amenities. And so clubhouses and a lot of other things were fostered. Mm-hmm. Those weren't still in extant at the time we came here, but I think the idea of clubs and doing things together had continued in the Canal Zone. And of course there were just all sorts of things, from Foreign Legion to the Historical Society to garden clubs, whatever. Mm-hmm.
And what types of clubs did you participate in?
I think zero.
Zero, okay.
I worked with Boy Scouts a good deal, actually.
Okay.
I guess that's kind of like a club in the sense that mm-hmm. I really enjoyed the other adults that I worked with, but I spent a lot of time working in Boy Scouts. I was in the American Society. I was an officer of one kind or another in that for a long time. Those were, initially it was for Americans who were in business downtown. Later it was for any Americans here. Mm-hmm. And, it was kind of an active way to get together.
Wow. Was that kind of a business kind of association, like the Chamber of Commerce, or I've never heard?
Not really. It was really quite social.
Okay.
The Garden Club, for example, was wonderful because it had no purpose, it had no officers, it had no constitution. Mm-hmm. And it took place at a lady who is called Morgan's Gardens, Pat Morgan. She'd been a nurse at front in World War I in France, and had gardens for economic purposes. Uh-huh. And she was the one really that kept it going, even when she was quite old.
Okay.
So that was the ideal society that we didn't have to spend 2 years writing a new constitution ever. You just went and had a good time.
Right. And after your graduate internship or graduate work at Stanford, did you come back and work as a practicing doctor, or?
At that time I came back and I did adolescent medicine mm-hmm. in the pediatrics department, and I was in public health. I did a lot of work in the schools, did some work in well baby clinics. Gradually over time, I did more and more just straight public health preventive medicine and a lot more administrative time. Although I saw, all during my career, I always had 2 days a week where I saw patients, because I don't believe a doctor who stops seeing patients knows what medicine is about after a couple of years.
Uh-huh. What were the facilities that you had to work with in the Canal Zone? How would those have compared to facilities, say, in the United States at the same time?
Not as slick looking, but basically better.
Better, okay.
And I didn't have funding problems. I mean, later on, when I was in charge of all of that, I just didn't have any funding problems. Mm-hmm.
The work was funded by the U.S. government, or the...
No, everything here was funded by the ships going through the canal.
Okay.
And what was left over went to the U.S. government. I mean, I don't know what it was over time, but millions of dollars were paid into the U.S. Treasury over the American life of the canal. Mm-hmm. If there were a worldwide recession and shipping tonnage went down, then we had to cut stuff out of our budget. Mm-hmm. We always had to have a plan for what was going to be cut in some kind of rank order in case the ship transits went down. But for the most part, it was such that if you're a credible manager, you didn't have any trouble with funding.
Mm-hmm. What were the politics like of the country at that time in Panama?
In Panama,
yes, sir.
Well, when we came back in 1961, it was fairly much like it had been since the opening of the canal, since the time the gringos came here. And things were, there were tensions between Panama and the United States, and in 1964 there was a real confrontation with shooting and breaking diplomatic relations, mm-hmm. Closing of the bridge. By the time we came back in 1970, it was clear that the United States' hold on the canal was going to end sometime. There was an attempt to do a treaty in 1967, but it was broken when the three colonels came to power in 1968. Torrijos was the one of the three colonels that was left standing, and he was pretty much in charge of the country by the time we came back in 1970. Initially, he was quite benign, and I will give him credit for pouring money into universities, schools, and health. The other thing that Torrijos did was open the way for black people and Indians and Chinese, who up until that time could not expect ever to rise very high in the government. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm sure there were exceptions, there always are, but in general, a black kid faced a real uphill fight, even if he was very clever and well-educated to do. Mm-hmm. Enter not society, but levels of employment either in the government or private business in Panama. And Torrijos broke that. Panama changed totally from that, and that's still true.
Mm-hmm. What kind of, as you think back on, say, the political, social system in Panama, Dr. Chevelle, what kind of impact did the U.S. have on any of this, on, say, the three colonels or the social system in Panama?
Well, my own personal opinion is the three colonels would not have overthrown Arnulfo Arias and come to power without some kind of backdoor agreement with the U.S. military here or the State Department or both. Mm-hmm. It's inconceivable to me that they would have, because the United States had intervened enough times that they had that as a good example. That's me speaking. I've never run into anything written about that, but I think that's not something that would appear very easily either. Torrijos played, he always dressed in a fatigue uniform, mm-hmm. a la Castro, and he toured the country a lot and made a lot out of starting peasant things. There was a lot of interchange with Cuba. There was nationalization of a lot of farms, small farms, to create huge state-owned sugar plantations up in the interior. So there was a fair amount of movement in a leftward economic disposition of the country. This started, I think, with a lot of enthusiasm initially, and I don't know, I mean, I'm not in a position to know how things got started, but gradually, I think, on the top first, people began drilling holes in the cash box and catching mm-hmm. what came out, and if the top guy is taking, the next guy down feels he has a right, the next guy and the next guy. So gradually, the system had more and more troubles for people that were well connected in the government or even on lower levels, mm-hmm. doing things for their own purposes. Also, a lot of economic situations in Panama were carved up amongst the colonels and lieutenant colonels, so that if a guy had the telephones, for example, a colonel, I can't remember his name, but one colonel had the telephones, and there were, a lot of money had to go out to get a new telephone system, and the more you put, the faster you got one. Mm-hmm. He didn't do anything, he just collected the money. Mm-hmm. And, That's an example, but that occurred in many facets of economic life in Panama. But up until Noriega, otherwise the surface was really quite peaceable. I'm not going to say there weren't tensions, but there were. But early on, there were a lot of desaparecidos under Torrijos and the colonels. I had some video clips of people digging up graves and identifying people that opposed the regime and disappeared. There was the case of Padre Gallegos. He was a Colombian priest who was rather leftist and working for the poor, and he disappeared. He was working up in Veraguas, where Torrijos came from, and he disappeared. It's alleged that he had a leg of pork tied to his leg and dropped off in the shark channel out here. Nobody really knows. And there was a lot of to-do over that. And I think that's the main one that I remember. But there were little things going on. People occasionally were shot. I was involved in a visit for President Carter in 1977. And five kids died at the University of Panama that night in some demonstrations against him. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't until Noriega that things really turned sour.
Mm-hmm. When President Carter came to visit, what was the reception given to him?
Quite positive. Mm-hmm. Quite positive. I mean, look, the Panamanians had felt that they had been screwed by the United States in 1903, and to some extent they had been. And they'd been wanting things better for a long time. For example, in the 20s and 30s, you could only drive in the canal zone if you had a canal zone license. So Panamanian families going to the interior, when they got to the border of the zone west of Panama City, would have to hire a driver to drive through the canal zone because they were not allowed to drive through the canal zone. If you were what's called a Rabi Blanco. Rabi Blanco is a bird that looks like it's wearing a tuxedo. And so the term for very rich old family people here is Rabi Blanco. And if you were Rabi Blanco, you could get a permit, but the average citizen couldn't. Mm-hmm. And kids who came over to get mangoes were chased out. There was a lot of prejudice against Panama. It varied from person to person. There were a lot of people from the South and of interest from New England who carried a lot of prejudice against the Panamanians who were here.
And so when President Carter visited in 77, there Panamanians at least kind of saw him in a positive light.
Oh yes, by all means. I mean, they were getting Panama back. Mm-hmm. The canal zone was coming back lock, stock, and barrel. The negotiations were finished in 1977. The place that it was going to start taking place 2 years later in 1979. Mm-hmm. So I think there was a rather outpouring of positive feelings for President Carter.
Mm-hmm. How about within the zone itself?
I'm not terribly sure about that because we weren't born here, and none of us had the feeling that it was a birthright. On the other hand, there are a lot of people in the canal zone whose grandparents or great-grandparents came down to build the canal, and the family had been there ever since, and they looked upon this as their birthright, their homeland, and they simply didn't want the canal to go. There are other people that were a fairly large, at least compared to me, farther to the right, who felt that for other reasons that the canal zone shouldn't go. If you want to see a practical reason for that, draw a 1,500-mile radius around Howard Air Force Base, and then draw one around Homestead Air Force Base and see how much you can command in Latin America by air.
Right, yeah.
And so, I think there are military reasons where in the treaty we might have wanted to control something. So there were people that were like that. But there was a great deal of opposition to the treaty, and there were a number of people that worked very hard to try to derail the treaty in any way that they could. Mm-hmm. I think the number of people who were either neutral or else for the treaty was a good deal more than was publicly thought, because those who were against it were very outspoken. If you were a moderate leftist today, in a meeting of Tea Party people, you might keep your mouth shut. Mm-hmm. I think that would be a good analogy.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting you mentioned that, Dr. Chevelle, because the people that we've interviewed so far talk about the Canal Zone as being almost like an exception to American life in general. I mean, the description is often, it was almost like it was a static world in a way, that things didn't change in the zone the way things were changing in the United States. Is that fair to say, or is that?
That's true to some extent. I mean, everything always changes, and there were significant changes from 1963 when I left after being an intern to when a family came back toward the end of 1970. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were a lot of changes, and they did affect the Canal Zone. But I think that's a fair statement to say. A friend here who was in business downtown, who had been in Argentina at the start, English in Argentina, there are a lot of English people in, mm-hmm. in BA, and he had been in Argentina at the start of World War II, went back and fought with the Brits, mm-hmm. then came back to Argentina, and the reason he went back to Argentina is because he said it was like Britain when he was a small child. Mm-hmm. And I think there's some truth in that. I think people looked at the Canal Zone as something like 1935 to 1950 in perpetuity.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a good feeling. I mean, I'll grant you that I had a certain amount of comfort for that. I grew up in a little bitty small town in the Middle West.
Yeah.
And not terribly happy with a lot of the social movements that we have going on, economic movements in the United States. I have some discomfort for that, so.
Mm-hmm. So there's a sense of stability maybe in the zone.
Sure.
Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was
gonna ask you what kind of, so far people have not really mentioned the types of political figures that you often hear of people talking about in the 60s, like John F. Kennedy or Lyndon Johnson or Martin Luther King, or did that have any impact?
We came from California. In 1970, and I had been in San Francisco and Palo Alto during all that turbulence. I mean, we were there when the Flower Children started in Golden Gate Park, and used to go spend some time in Haight-Ashbury. And you know, up until I left in 1970, there had been 68 murders in the Haight-Ashbury district, most of the drug wars, which is what the Flower Children came to. So in that sense, I think that it was kind of unchanging. I think down here, people had no idea of the real social turmoil that was going on. People got drafted and went off to Vietnam. My time in the Army was during the Korean War, and nobody in the United States raised hell about getting drafted in the Korean War. That just wasn't done. It wasn't a part of our culture. At the time, all of that was happening in the United States during the Vietnamese War, draft card burning, people saying, save the whale, sacrifice Joan Fonda, all that that kind of stuff. That was not happening down here. It just wasn't, it was absent.
Mm-hmm. But people kind of knew it was happening at a distance, you think, or they just didn't really?
The kids in high school emulated to some extent, and we did have a drug problem. In fact, I was kind of recruited back here to deal with a drug problem, young people more than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
But they started talking about it, and having come from the Bay Area in 1970, I had a hard time seeing what the hell they were talking about initially about the big drug problem. It was here,
mm-hmm.
and it was significant, but comparatively speaking, not much.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned earlier that it was almost a sense that people could see a treaty, a renegotiation of some kind coming on the horizon.
Well, there were treaty negotiations, and first of all, the white paper about the Canal Zone was written in the Eisenhower administration,
mm-hmm.
and is extant in archives up there. And the federal government was dedicated to having some kind of different arrangement with Panama from 1955 on. And a treaty was actually negotiated in 1967, 1968, but that went out the window when the colonels came to power. The government may have had something to do with that. I can suspect that, but could never know.
We may find out 50 years from now or something. Or
Somebody's archives will be
open. Right, exactly. Did you, were you still in the canal zone? I guess I should kind of back and ask when you retired.
1994, first of 1994.
Okay.
I lived through all of everything for 3 years, from 1976 through a little while after the treaty took effect. I was the president of the Pacific Civic Council, which was essentially the elected mayor of the canal zone. Mm-hmm. So I lived through all kinds of stuff, making arrangements for older people to be taken care of, trying to make some arrangements with some people in Panama, looking into what kind of retirements that people would have. I appeared before Congress probably 10 or 12 times during that period of time. So for somebody who was not paid to be in that position, probably was a central to all the negotiations and everything that went on, as it could have been.
Mm-hmm. So as president of the Civic, you're president of the Civic Council, and that was kind of like, in some ways, being the leader, was kind of the civic society in some ways, right?
Well, it would be like anything. I mean, people elect a mayor, but that's not all the political activity that goes on.
Yeah.
Our neighbor at that time was one of the most active people against the treaty and was crazy radical. And we were glad when he moved, because we were always afraid they'd blow up his house and we'd get hit by a little shrapnel.
Oh, no.
Did you talk about the black? I think it's very important. Can I as part of the whole Civic Council, I think the understanding of the black communities and the white communities, I suppose you have gotten some of this information and what happened through the treaty and your experience, who was it, with Metcalf?
Yes, Congressman Metcalf.
Metcalf.
Ralph
Metcalf. You need to go back to the...
He was a congressman from Louisiana, but he was on the... He was second to Jesse Owens in the 36 Olympics in Berlin in the 100-meter dash. Uh-huh. He was on the 400-meter relay that set a world record with Jesse Owens that stood for a long period of time and had been in Congress. He was I got to know him very well. And I don't know, there was an earlier date when, for some reason, all of the canal zone had to have schools speaking the same language. That's how it was going to be. Your people going to speak the same language. And in order to keep the blacks, the schools were segregated. Hospital was segregated still when I got here in 1961. The wards were segregated. Mm-hmm. The euphemism was local rate and U.S. rate, which went back to how people were paid during the construction.
Mm-hmm.
And in the schools, what happened is overnight, it was decided that all the black people were Panamanian, so they would go to a Spanish-speaking school. The teachers were told if they wanted to teach in the fall, they better learn some Spanish.
Mm.
Do you know what year that was? I don't
remember that.
That was sometime before the treaty.
Mm-hmm.
But at any rate, part of the treaty was that any black kids that continued to live in the canal zone after the treaty would all go to the U.S. schools. And there was a fair amount of opposition to that, and there were some difficulties. They weren't all easy to teach kids. There were a few more problems per whatever unit of number of kids there were. That's what happened in the United States. So that happened here late, and was associated with the treaty, and there was a lot of opposition to that, but there were no problems of parents lining up and spitting on kids or anything of that sort, just a lot of talk and unhappiness.
Mm-hmm.
And they melded the kids in, starting with 1 year, so that after a certain amount of time, all of the grades would include the blacks. But the ones, say, who were in the black high schools, at the time this happened, in local rate high schools, they would graduate without ever going to the U.S. schools. And there were a lot of Spanish-speaking people in those schools, and they simply changed to schools in Panama. Mm-hmm. There was some of that that took place, too. Mm-hmm.
So there's a fair amount of segregation within the different institutions in the Canal Zone, especially schools and church, or hospitals.
Well, I remember when we first got here, we were driving. We bought ourselves a little black VW about 3 days after we got here, and we were driving around to look at what we were going to be living in for a while. We came around the corner, and there were some guys digging for a sewer or a water pipe or something, and there were five black guys sitting down in the hole, and there was a big, tall, fat, white guy leaning against a palm tree reading the newspaper. There was a lot of that.
Uh-huh.
Supervising,
right, yeah.
But there were a lot of other ideas. I remember a guy who was the superintendent of the locks on the Atlantic side. He was a very good friend of mine. And after the treaty, we had a lot of retirements, both U.S. and Panamanians as well. And I was asking how he was working without all the U.S. people. And he said, "You know, Dick, it's not the U.S. people that are causing me trouble." He says, it's the old 55-year-old guy that pulls on my sleeve and says, "Hey, boss man, we had the same problem back in 1952. This is what we do then. Why don't you try that? I think it'd fix it, boss." He said, "Those are the guys that are causing me trouble to mm-hmm. run the locks, mm-hmm. their absence." Mm-hmm. And in the midst of this, you know, there was a lot of camaraderie also between whites and blacks, and good friendships of people that worked together. So that I don't want to leave the impression that it was like the South in 1935 either. Mm-hmm. It never was that hard.
Mm-hmm. What kind of as ships were coming through, would you say Panama was, did the ships have an impact on social life? Did people pick up news from people coming through the canal, or were those people coming through more like a transient?
I think later they didn't have any effect at all. Perhaps earlier, mm-hmm. before radios, before television, perhaps there were, the tourist made some difference. But as far as affecting the lives really of people in Panama, the cultures were different enough that somebody coming through on a transient basis, I don't think, could really affect the life of anybody in Panama. They were just people going by.
Okay.
You know, wave at them and act like a native and let it go with that.
Right, yeah. Uh-huh. And you, were you president of the Civic Council during Operation Just Cause, or is that after?
No, that Just Cause was quite a bit later. That's a decade later. Just Cause was in 1989, and I can't tell you the date, but let's say early in 1980, I finished 3 terms, and that was it. I had done my duty.
What were some of your most difficult duties as president of the?
Well, I don't know about difficult. Probably the most difficult part were that there were certainly people on the Civic Council who were radically against the treaty, mm-hmm. and trying to balance that. I developed techniques for how the meeting ran depending on what I expected. If I thought it was going to be really wild and bad, I would not cut off any discussion. I'd let people talk as long as they wanted to, and all of a sudden it would be 10 o'clock and we'd have to go home. Mm-hmm. Nothing happened. If it was going to be peaceable, then I'd control the meeting and have a direction to go. I mean, but that's nothing that's what people do if they're running a meeting any place. You develop techniques to try to avoid that so that you might take people head on. Mm-hmm. Also, another technique I used is if people raised a lot of hell, I'd ask three of the worst of them to develop a position paper that we could look at, and usually they never did. Mm-hmm. And they'd be quiet after that.
Okay, that's a good technique. And you mentioned going to give congressional testimony. Was that testimony on behalf of the council, or was that
people in the council? American people in the council.
Okay. And how did you put together? What was the process of? Were you canvassing people in the canal zone for their ideas?
Well, from my position, I didn't really have to do that.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I got every. I don't even remember how often we met now. It was monthly or what? I think as it got busier for the treaty, it was even more often than once a month. But mm-hmm. I think I had a pretty good ear for that. The other thing is that I'd go down to shop the commissary. And I usually couldn't get out without two or three people telling me what they really thought, how I should manage things, what I should tell a governor. So I didn't, and maybe I'm not quite that democratic, I try to put together what I could.
Yeah.
And only if for some things I would do some canvassing to find out. But in general, I had some people that I knew and trusted, some more conservative, some more liberal, who I would consult what they thought about this and that, or something that I was writing, because I wrote all my position papers totally when I was going to testify.
Mm-hmm. And did you, when you went to testify, did you find a receptive audience in Congress? Were people trying to kind of gauge American opinion within the canal, or were they?
Sometimes, I know, I don't think I ever found anybody that cared in Washington that cared a fig about what people in the canal zone thought.
Uh-huh.
We were sort of kind of strange people set off in the distance.
Can I interrupt you for just a moment? Because one of the things that happened, not only did the representatives from Panama, from the canal zone, go and appear before Congress, we continually had a group of congressmen, as they like to do, is to come down and to visit the canal zone, mm-hmm. apparently on a fact-finding mission.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the social gatherings that was el vigor during any senatorial or congressional meeting was to go on a midnight cruise from Balboa on one of the I don't remember what ship it was, Eastwood.
Well, I don't remember the ship either, but we had a ship that would go through the locks, not on the lake. And,
mm-hmm.
and then turn around and come back.
Okay.
And so
it was a cruise ship, primarily for visiting dignitaries, although people in the canal zone could rent it and use it.
But during some of those midnight, visits, that when we were invited to, have dinner and socialize with, and particularly with, who was Senator Congressman Spellman. She came out of the Department of Education herself. She mm-hmm. was, and as a board member or something like that.
She started a school board in Maryland.
And she was very interested in education.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that we've particularly worked with her all night, in fact, was to incorporate within, whether it was the treaty or whatever it was, and one of the things was to have a sabbatical for teachers, because it was very difficult for them to get additional education coming mm-hmm. out of the canal zone. And so there were some perks like that
mm-hmm.
that actually effectively got into some of the negotiations. And I think everybody on those ships that night had something to tell a congressman that they wanted to
have
uh-huh. in the treaty.
Yeah, it was variable. She was quite interested. Metcalf was quite interested. I remember a lot who were not interested. I remember congresspeople, senators, or representatives who already had their own idea, and you'd back off quickly because you sensed they were soon going to be pissed off because you didn't agree with their preconceived picture.
Mm-hmm.
But the two best lobbying points were the boat, the ship, and the train, because we went to the other side by train, and people would come down for fact finding, and we'd ride right over on the train. I remember our daughter went to school, a school that was right on the border. It was a small school, and her class looked like the United Nations. There was a little Scottish boy who was as blonde and blue-eyed as you could be, mm-hmm. right up to totally black kids with everything in between. And they had been at Congressman Metcalf all day, black people on the other side. And I almost countered everything that was said by showing him a picture of my daughter's class. Mm-hmm. With these smiling kids that look like a biblical picture of the lion and the lamb.
Uh-huh.
I'll think of it. It just went. Uh-huh. I think, Dick, you ought to talk about the experience. It was not your experience with what happened with President Carter and the president of the union, of the pilot union. Because that was very significant.
Yeah,
in
actually,
the treaty.
Actually, I was half of that, and he was half of that, because we had people were going to finish early, and it was going to change, and we were looking for some kind of better retirement for people that were going to lose a lifestyle and a job.
Yeah,
and be cut off early. And there was a fellow who was the president of the Pilots Association, who had a friend that was on Jimmy Carter's interior staff in the White House. And,
Jordan?
No. I don't think, well, it could have been Hamilton Jordan. I'm not sure about that, I just know that. And anyway, between, that was a lot of stuff that I did with Representative Spellman and Metcalf both. And actually it was a troika three ways. Then president of the Pilots Association got with somebody on Carter's staff. I don't know the details, but he was highly effective, mm-hmm. in regard to the people. And there was a representative guy that was later indicted from Pennsylvania, and I can't bring his name up, but he was the one that actually put the bill before the House.
Mm-hmm. But in our conversation, previous to that, the Pilot Association had a problem with the administration of the canal. And I don't remember what the issue was, but you can't go on strike against the government.
Yeah.
But you can have a sick out.
Mm-hmm.
And the pilots had a sick out. And the teachers supported the pilots with an additional sick out.
And a lot of other people as well.
And a lot of other people as well. And
this was during the Carter administration?
This was
later, and I don't know when.
Well, this was before the treaty, because when our conversation, and I forget the name of the Pilot Association's president.
John. I don't either. He left shortly after the treaty.
But he had the friend. He got an appointment with Carter, and Carter said, "What do you want?" Because Carter wanted the treaty.
Yeah.
He said, well, and one of the things from conversations that you and other people had with John was they were asking for what is called, what, an 1848? 18 years and 48 years old. You could retire without penalty, mm-hmm. from the U.S. government. At that point, as a way of easing people out, and what Dick was saying about protecting them.
You could take your equity and run. Not that you're going to get fantastically great retirement, but that if you really felt threatened by it, or things changed so your job died, you could take your equity and run.
Okay.
And so at that point, Carter said, "You've got it."
Mm-hmm.
And John said, "I want everybody to have it in the canal zone." And the reason why he said that, because again, there was this closeness among people and watching, mm-hmm. out for one another.
Yeah, that's.
And so he wanted to protect everybody, not just the pilots.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, the teachers went on the line for us.
Yeah.
I want it for everybody, mm-hmm. in the canal zone. And he got it in too.
Wow, so you were able to take your seniority, and you could either retire or apply it to another.
You could go to another government agency.
Another government agency.
But the
okay.
main thing, if you had to leave, you had that little bit without penalty.
Without penalty. Okay.
That you could take with you.
It was fairly favorable, but that wasn't enough in itself, because only Congress could say that. Carter couldn't say that. He could
That's
say
right.
I will support it, but
yeah.
It was Murphy. I think Congressman Murphy. Bob, that's a question mark.
Okay.
In Pennsylvania. He was very friendly. He was on the committee that oversaw the canal. He was the one that introduced it.
Is that Murtha?
No, not Murtha. That's DOD.
Right.
Murtha's DOD. It was Murphy, I think.
Murphy, okay.
Try that. I'm not sure about that.
Okay. But eventually it was approved.
Well, the sick out was interesting, because mm-hmm. down from the Pentagon came all this thing, we're going to fire everybody. We're going to run the canal with the Navy. And after they just about sunk half a dozen ships, they folded.
Uh-huh.
They found they couldn't run the canal.
Oh, okay.
Without. So there was the people who went out got scared. And the people who were going to fire them all got scared too, because they didn't, you know, nobody that's managing wants to have something fail on their watch.
Yeah.
So everybody got a little cooler.
Mm-hmm.
That's my view.
Okay, but the strike happened during the Carter administration, or?
I guess it did. I can't put that together. I guess that was during the treaty negotiations.
Because
I'd say 78 then. Let's say 1978.
Okay, we can ballpark.
Yeah, you can find that out, but I'd say 78.
Yeah, this is the first time anyone has mentioned this.
Not many people understood what was going on.
Oh.
You know, under the table. Well,
there's another factor, and that is the State Department had a giant bug up its butt about people in the canal zone anyway.
Mm-hmm.
There was a 50-year fight between the Pentagon, the Panama Canal Commission, and the State Department. And the State Department oriented everybody coming down, and they had all the stuff about all the manicured lawns and people who were taken care of so royally who lived here. And so, you know, there was some real prejudice. I know this because I had friends from down at the embassy, and I dealt with them an awful lot during this time. And
mm-hmm.
they used to tell me about their orientation before coming here and laughing about it. One colonel who was the head of the unit out at Fort Clayton, who I worked with in Boy Scouts, and you know, after about 2 years, he said, "You know, this is the best place I've ever had in my whole service career." He says, "It's a shame it's coming to an end, or I would try to stay here and work." He said, "They really poisoned me about what you people in the canal zone were like, and I found you to be very good people, like those mm-hmm. in my hometown."
So the Pentagon gave him a certain image of the civilians.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the State Department both. I don't know who did the orienting. Maybe they both did it, and that may be, there's a certain amount of canal zone paranoia
uh-huh.
in that, maybe even in my part, but I do really think that's quite true. I mean, primarily because I heard it from people uh-huh. in the military and in the embassy.
Well, interestingly enough, I mean, even though I was not in country as much in Fort Davis, we heard the same thing about civilian life, actually. And it was like, the way it was presented to us was, oh, those people, it's like a city on the hill, and they have it's paradise for them, and you guys are in the jungle, and you're, you know. So we were, there was never any, it was interesting because interviewing a couple yesterday, they said, oh, we had great relations with the military. And I thought, wow, I don't think we had negative relations when I was there, but we just didn't have any relations that I remember. It would have been different for officers, maybe. But
yeah, I think that's really true. First of all, the head of the hospital was always from the Army.
Yeah,
the governor was a major general. The lieutenant governor was a colonel who was shortly to be a brigadier general unless he screwed up. Engineering department was overseen by military engineers. I mean, it was a combination thing. And actually, the secretary of the Army was essentially the president of the board of directors for the Panama Canal.
Mm-hmm.
And that went back from the time construction was over. So beyond that, if you got to the officer's staff at Fort Clayton, or especially out at Amador with the Navy and the Marines and
yeah.
the Army, relations were quite good.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of people in the canal zone didn't want their daughters running around with enlisted men. And if you had a daughter and had been here, you probably would have taken the same view.
Right. So there was State Department, Pentagon, I mean, there were different groups who saw themselves as having a stake in the canal zone.
Well, there was a real battle, mm-hmm. which I only heard of just through Dick and other forces about who really was going to control the canal zone. And there was this continual battle mm-hmm. between the powers that be, namely those three forces. And it was a little tug and, you know, pull all the time.
Mm-hmm. So when the treaty went into effect, you can guess some of the winnings because the head of the agency became a lieutenant general.
Mm-hmm.
Who was very good. Who was very good. He came with, for me, a bad reputation because I knew some people up at Cory Heights that worked for him, and he was prone to do things like getting everybody up at 2 a.m. in the morning to go to have a review of some situation, which I thought was just a good show. He was powerful. But he never demonstrated any of that while he was head of the agency. And I worked with him a lot, sat in a lot of meetings, and I just thought he was excellent.
That was General McCullough.
Yeah.
General McCullough.
Do you tell him about your invitation when you met in the treaty negotiations with some of the very, very wealthy power players in Panama?
Oh, that was interesting. There were a few of us that came over that were not in the power structure that much in the canal zone or in the company. But it included three guys, one who was the foreign minister and two had been foreign ministers, and some very powerful people. And essentially, they were essentially trying to bribe us to come out for the treaty and support it. Of course, I hadn't been publicly terribly supportive of the treaty, but I'd been pro-treaty from the first. It didn't seem to me like our country should really control Panama. This is Panama.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, I was never contacted, but some of the other people that were in that group were contracted by McAuliffe, actually. No, that was Parfitt at that time. That was before the treaty. General Parfitt, who in kind of a general way suggested it would really be better to leave all the routes of negotiation to the pros in the State Department and the Pentagon.
Mm-hmm.
But you were pretty well offered, weren't you? You know, what would you like?
No, I was the only one that was not. Interestingly enough, I don't know why that was. Later on, I was offered, but that was the time I was offered clear bribes was when we were building when we put together the $10 million contract for the retired people from Pan Canal in Panama, the old black folks downtown. Before the treaty was over, I managed to con money out to build a home for them,
mm-hmm.
a silo, and that was done through one of the three at that time big clinics in Panama.
Mm-hmm.
We had it out on bid, and the largest, most famous clinic at that time was Centro Medico Paitia, and the head of that guy offered me a bunch of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of shut them out after that. They didn't have low bid. I'd have been very unhappy if they had.
Mm-hmm.
But the time that we all met, everybody else openly was offered something, and I'm not quite sure why I wasn't, but I wasn't.
Oh, offered something to support the treaty.
Yeah, I mean, I'm talking about position and money in Panama to stay.
Oh, interesting.
Quite concrete.
Mm-hmm. And your feeling was it was offered by private individuals or by?
Well, it was a mixed group.
Uh-huh.
Fernando, the hell is his last name? Anyway, he's a family from Spain who left during the Civil War.
Okay.
He went to Stanford from Panama, studied philosophy, decided he couldn't make a living, so he studied engineering, set up the first television station, two radio stations, and by the time I knew him, he was rich as Midas. Fernando Eleita.
Mm-hmm.
And, he had nothing to do with the government, and some of them were very much in opposition to the government. But this is before Noriega, so the opposition wasn't bloody or deadly at that time. There was a lot in the newspapers, and there were angry feelings and a lot of worry about the direction Panama was taking. But people on both sides of the spectrum, or all seven sides of the spectrum, could sit down and talk together in Panama's interest at that time. Mm-hmm. And there was so much coming out against the treaty in the United States, both in the United States, but some of it originating here, that they really thought it would be nice to have some people who thought it was leaders in the canal zone come in on that side. I essentially didn't do anything. I just went to the meeting.
What were your impressions of Noriega?
Well, I shook his hand three times. I've not been able to feel anything since. Noriega was evil. Probably, now there's some very bad things done when the three colonels were in power, because there was a lot of opposition to that. And some of the video that you saw, I don't know what you saw, but that we were looking at yesterday that I put together, is finally after Operation Just Cause, they were able to dig up the graves of students that disappeared and other people that disappeared that could be identified. So my own opinion is more people were killed under Torrijos than under Noriega, but I don't know that that's true. I'm a contrarian in that regard.
Okay.
But he was an evil man, and he had a technique, so almost inborn, of reading people and knowing what their weaknesses were. And he had like a resort hotel that catered to anybody's weaknesses. If you liked little boys, there'd be little boys. If you liked whores, you could get a whore. If you wanted to get high on cocaine, there'd be cocaine. And while this was happening, pictures were being taken to archive that could be used later or to get rid of you. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting. We were in Somerville, South Carolina. We lived in Charleston for a while, and I bought a car from an ex-colonel who had been involved in that and almost lost his career. He didn't ever tell me exactly what happened. But anyway, he got involved in Noriega this way down here as a colonel and almost destroyed his career, because if Noriega didn't get what, if he wanted something and approached you and he didn't get it, then mm-hmm. it would cause you a lot of trouble. Mm-hmm. Lila's colleague, why don't you tell about Coralia and Noriega and his relationship with the troops and the officers?
Well, I do folklore in Panama, and one of my colleagues is Coralia Hassan de Llorente. Her husband was a captain in the military, and her brother was one of the very high colonels working with Noriega. And
he was like the general staff. He was one of the half a dozen main guys.
Colonel Hassan. And Colonel Hassan was, you know, just doing his job. But apparently through Coralia, he was just swept in to Noriega's command, because Noriega was able and would offer them. They would just offer them in this hotel, they would offer them women, they would offer them booze, I mean, whatever mm-hmm. they wanted. He himself, I think personally, had a certain charisma mm-hmm. among his officers, and that they smoothed and pulled in mm-hmm. to be very faithful, and then they were very afraid of him mm-hmm. because they knew his techniques, they knew what he was doing, and it could happen to them. Mm-hmm. So loyalty that was gratuitous in the beginning then became mandatory if you wanted to save your life.
It's easier to mount the tiger than to get off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But this spilled over into if the child of a corporal were really sick and in the hospital, something from Noriega would show up, or even Noriega himself. So he extended himself for the soldiers and for the officers in a kindly, supporting way as well, too.
In the true patrono system that is known in Panama. And so he did become also, as well as evil, he also became the patron.
Yeah, he had a certain charisma.
And under the patronal system is, again, the peon works for the, you know, but he also gives him the birthday party, gives him the all of the Catholic type of thing. He pays for the marriages. He, you know, the patron is the one that really supports at times of celebrations.
There has to be some kind of reciprocal.
That's right.
Yeah, there's a responsibility
out,
of. Yeah.
It came out of Spain and it's universal in Latin America. You know, if trouble happens and shit falls on the household, the patron shows up with a shovel.
There was a perception that, at least in the beginning, that the U.S. Either tolerated or even openly supported Noriega. And was that, did you see that?
And he worked for the CIA. I can't answer that question. I say that's a perception, although I do know that the president of Panama, I'm preceding Noriega. Mm. No, not either. That was still true. I guess Lacus. I'm not going to go there because I'm not very sure of my data. But at any rate, the thought was that through the Mill Group in Panama, these are military folks attached to the embassy, working with the Panamanian army, that there were guns and other supplies going in out of the back door of the embassy to Noriega, literally up until the time that the war started. So we had a little trouble with the right hand not knowing what the left hand was doing as well. And this I really know.
Dick, don't you think also, though, that you have to look at Noriega, not Noriega, but Torrijos, in the light of Arias, Arnulfo, and you have to know the history of Arnulfo, what a dictator he was, what an autocrat he was, you know, wasn't he for Germany during the Second World War?
No, yeah, he was, but we need to go back further because he got a Becker scholarship to go to Germany to study neurosurgery in the early 1930s, and he did his residency in neurosurgery in Germany in the 30s. He'd gone to medical school at Harvard, so he clearly wasn't an idiot. And came back to the United States and started the Panamanista Party, and they made a symbol with a lightning bolt. It was yellow on a purple background. You may still see some, and the Arnulfistas are still a powerful party. But then he organized his party really very much on a fascist level. And he was very close personally to the German ambassador to Panama and the Japanese ambassador to Panama. There was a lot of tic-tac-toe going on in 1940 and 1941. One of the tic-tac-toes is that Lloyd Area, which is a German airline, was building an airline or an airport in the jungle in Colombia within 150 miles of Panama. And they were bringing in Hankel 110s, which is a bomber, and they were calling them fast mail planes. And Franklin Roosevelt pushed and paid for Colombia to take this over. That became Avianca, which to this day is really probably Latin America's best airline, Avianca. And we threw Arnulfo out at that time because I don't know the details of how he was kicked out, but he was thrown out three times, twice by the United States, and that's why when I said I can't believe that the colonels would throw Arnulfo out without some connivance from Quarry Heights, which was the high command for the military here.
And so even though you have two bad peas in the pod, which is the worst pea that you throw out, and I think that was, I'm just guessing, but that was the U.S. dilemma at that time when the three colonels came to power and the U.S. saw we better back the colonels rather than Arias.
Well, there was a hassle between the three colonels. At that time, Noriega was in the Mill Group for the Panamanians in Mexico. No, Torrijos had gone to Mexico, and Noriega was in charge of the area up by the Costa Rican border. And when Torrijos came back, he came to Panama through San Jose, Costa Rica, and then they started a march down the isthmus, sort of like Mussolini marching in the 20s on Rome. and they picked up people as they came along, and there would have been no Torrijos without Noriega, which was probably why Torrijos was so faithful. But I don't, I'm afraid I don't see a connection philosophically between Arnulfo and Torrijos. If there's a connection, it would be a much closer
No, I'm talking about from the American perspective.
Oh, yeah.
That from the American perspective, if you had the elected president in Panama, who was Arnulfo, mm-hmm. and knowing the history of Arnulfo, and he was a little crazy, and then these colonels coming to power, mm-hmm. who would you choose mm-hmm. to back? And I think at that point that probably yeah. we didn't have a choice but and, to go for the colonels.
And there, yeah, I mean, and you had mentioned.
We had a choice, we just didn't take, I think we took the wrong choice personally.
But there was a list. That's my opinion.
And it's all understandable. I mean, you know, anybody that thinks that the American government acts the same overseas as it does at home is a naive fool.
Well, and there are the broader. There's it isn't just Panama. It isn't just the canal. It's the broader region, hemisphere. And
that was a lot of the reason for the treaty.
Yeah,
holding on to it. Torrijos beat the hell out of us in terms of propaganda. Mm-hmm. In terms of moving toward the treaty, he had all of Latin America to talk about, the behemoth to the north, the shark and the sardines.
Mm-hmm. But I would also like to say, in terms of your experience in Panama was really with the mill groups in other countries in Latin America, and I think that was the entrance in terms of the U.S. was very interested in Southcom mm-hmm. and what they were doing, and I can't tell you how many people we talked to that were off to Peru, were off to Argentina, were off, and we knew exactly what was happening with the Southcom and their involvement all through South America. So I think your comment was very important because at that time it was not just Panama.
This was a huge CIA center. Mm-hmm. There's a huge listening post, and they had people that read newspapers from all of Latin America every day mm-hmm. to find little bits of information. It seemed like there was one period of time everybody we met turned out to be associated with the CIA in some way. Lila was doing folklore studies up, and she got a guy that she met, George Archer, who was a good photographer and was set up to do photography, and worked with him for a while, and all of a sudden he and his wife just split. You know, they disappeared. The two random kids disappeared, and we don't know where George went. But
George went back to CIA.
But his wife. It turned out later, I found out from other people, was with the agency.
Okay.
So there was a lot going on.
It was an interesting place.
That's an interesting.
Yeah, we needed Arthur Miller to write a book about Panama, right? That's interesting. Well, did you have, I know we've taken well over an hour already, and I know there's other activities that you probably want to get to. Thinking back now, well, let me ask this question. How often do the two of you go back to Panama?
I'll take a little time answering that. Life was pretty turbulent during the last years and right up through Just Cause.
Yeah.
And I was on a hit list, carried a radio around for a year and a half, 2 years, and if a message came through, hammer blow, I was to get hold of Lila, and we were to go someplace where we'd never been before, where there was a telephone, had a number to call, and the armored vehicle would pick us up. And we had big Ford sedans with blackened windows that would drive up in front of our house. We lived next door to the head of the Marine Bureau, and he was also on that list. And six guys with crew cuts and muscles under tight t-shirts would get up and go through some kind of exercise and get back in the car and drive away. These were Panamanian guardias who had a right to be there because it was Panama by that time. None of this really got through to me. I tolerated that all very well, but after it was over, when I watched the new government go into Panama and Dara got married to a Chinese chippy. Then he decided to haul into the cathedral, and he lived in the cathedral, what, for a month or 6 weeks, just some kind of crazy business. They were fighting like cats and dogs. Two people that I had pushed, Panamanians, for higher positions, like bureau directors, got caught for acting like Panamanians with contracts. One of them, for example, there were, for this cut widening thing that's going on right now, that started actually in about 1990, as a matter of fact. And there were 27 separate contracts involved, and he was either a part owner or on the board of directors in some way associated with 17 of the 27, and was asked to leave. And that's okay in Panama, but it wasn't. And I'm not quite sure why this bothered me. My friends used to say, well, just let Panama be Panama, forget about it. I was not really able to do that. I was quite angry when it was over. And we didn't come back for, I guess I came back for some depositions later. But beside that, we didn't come back for quite a long time. Now, we bought for 10 years a timeshare so that we have an apartment in Corey Heights for 3 weeks. That is in January and February, which is the early dry season, best part. And we come down every year for that. Lila's back into her folklore again, and our contacts with friends, and we've enjoyed that. But I was quite bitter when I left in 1994. I could have stayed longer, and I had no interest in doing so. And the part that got me is, I guess I expected more of the Panamanians, and I thought the Panamanian dead and the U.S. dead for unjust cause deserved better out of Panama than we were getting.
Did you, now when you talk to other folks in the reunion, do you find yourself, what do you talk about?
At this reunion, I talk about old days, or playing tennis together, or swimming, or mutual friends, or time that we've spent together. I'm going to talk about the canal. It would be with a few people that I would talk to. I think you were there when Rich Wenya was talking yesterday. He's the one that maybe
not.
No, I
think he was there.
Uh-huh. Oh, okay. It was the other guy who was there. Anyway, he's now head of the port at Tampa.
Okay.
And he was the chief economist for the Panama Canal at the end. Mm-hmm. And I would talk to him. I go back and I talk to some of my good friends in Panama who were people that I talked to a lot when I lived there, so that there would be people that I trust. But aside from that, I don't talk about old Pan Canal days. I will say it because everybody expected Panama to screw it up in 3 years when the turnover came. I'll occasionally remind people that it didn't, if I feel a little peakish, but that's about the end of what I'll talk about.
I'd like to go back to the whole feeling in the canal zone, because there are not very many places in a tropical, lush environment that you could go to the beach within an hour and a half. If you were hunting, you could go down to the Darien, you could go hunting. If you were a birder, you just go a half an hour out to Gamboa and go on Pipeline Road, and you see some of the most beautiful birds in the world. If you like scuba, you could go over to the Caribbean. And in that regard, fishing out in the bay, some of the best fishing in the world.
Yeah.
People, even the blue-collar workers, they could afford a boat. And things were kept, I don't think artificially cheap, but it was a time in which everybody could afford to do anything like that that they wanted to do.
Let me interject. That's another area where what people got was squished, so that it was not expensive to have your boat at the yacht club. The yacht club was built by Pan Canal people off duty. And if you had a little boat, you could afford to have it out there. As soon as the treaty occurred, that was gone. If you didn't, you had to be very wealthy all of a sudden, because the yacht club turned
to Panamanians.
To Panamanians, or like it would be in the United States mostly.
Mm-hmm. And so, I was involved in education, And one of the things that was very evident to the counselors at the secondary school was that Panama was so seductive in its lifestyle for people growing up in Panama that kids graduating from the high school, they wanted to stay there. Mm-hmm. And they would do anything that they could. They would take a mediocre job in mm-hmm. order to stay in Panama because the lifestyle was yeah. so beautiful. And in fact, Dick, with our own kids, we went to Panama thinking that we would travel internationally with the kids on our vacation. And then one day Dick came home and said, you know what? We got to get our kids back to the States, because what he was finding in his interviews with adolescents in the adolescent clinic, the same mentality of wanting to stay here and of being what they call this third world of kids growing up in the military outside of the United States, not really feeling comfortable as being U.S. citizens. Mm-hmm. So probably when the kids were about 8, something like that, they were, we, every year, we either sent them back with relatives to the States, or we took all our vacations back to the United States.
Back to the States, okay.
And we began to talk about, you're going to go to the college in the United States. This is where you're going to study. We began a real brainwashing so that there would be no alternatives for them to want to stay in Panama. At that time, and to have their higher education in the United States.
By the time we came back in 1970, it was clear that the days of the Canal Zone were numbered. That's before all this treaty stuff even started that much, but it was clear.
Mm-hmm. So you wanted to make sure that your kids would be able to adapt to life outside.
Yes. But, back into the States.
Yeah, but not everyone probably shared that belief, right? I mean, in terms of child rearing at the time.
I think a lot of people just had their children here, and when they got out of high school, they said, it's time to go to the States, or whatever happened. I don't like to set up a difference between, you know, people that had a lot of college education and blue-collar folks, but there is, and there wasn't quite as much forward-looking about that. But there were a lot of kids that stayed here no matter what, and are still here, just
doing
anything in Panama to get by. Some of them have done fairly well. If you're going to do that, you should go back and get a skill needed in Panama and then come back. That makes some sense, but otherwise. Yeah.
But in terms of the whole feeling of the Canal Zone and the comfort and just the beauty and just, mm-hmm. it was easy, it was a great life. And I think that what you talked about earlier in terms of people looking back on that,
yeah,
most people feel like, wow, and they did have something very special mm-hmm. there was something very unique about the Canal Zone.
And that's what makes it's that feeling that keeps this Panama Canal Society going. First of all, we were in our 30s, or we were both about 29 or 30 when we went to Panama the first time.
Is this interview room?
Yeah, come on
yes,
in.
Yes, sir.
Editor's note: at this point, there's an interruption in the interview, and it concludes without further information.